Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, it's G. Before we start this podcast, I want to warn you that this episode contains some very difficult themes, including discussion about depression, postpartum psychosis, and suicidal thoughts. If you feel uncomfortable hearing about any of those subjects, please press stop now and listen to another episode. Remember, if you need to speak to someone, the Samaritans offer support 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Visit samaritans.org for more information. Welcome to another episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guest is an author and her next book, What Have I Done, is published in May. It follows her experience of going into hospital 4 weeks after giving birth with postpartum psychosis. To me, I think it's going to be the most important book of 2020. Today's guest is Laura Dockrell.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm really good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I've literally just finished reading What Have I Done. I sent you a text afterwards and then I had to post about it online. It affected me and hit me in a way that no book has before. It broke me completely and then it weirdly healed me in some way. And not just reading your story, but kind of pairing it with my own and what I've been through over the last 5 years as a mum, and just kind of almost making me forgive myself in a way. And I think that is what got me so much. The honesty, the rawness, I just think it's going to be such a huge book. And I can't thank you enough for writing it.
I can't thank you enough, first of all, for those posts, because I write for my job. And when you do finish something, you do kind of send these books out to people, successful people that you hope are going to enjoy it or connect with it and share it, of course. And usually they kind of give you a nice, if you're lucky, packaged kind of quote. And
your one word.
One word. But your response was so immediate and emotional and connected with me. I really did feel like you were a mum meeting me at the other end, and that is exactly what I'm trying to do with this book. And so thank you too, because your reaction for me was like, oh god, she gets it. And that's all it is people getting it. Because when you are going through not just motherhood but a mental illness, or maybe any illness or any trauma, loneliness is always a thing that really gets you. And so you kind of, we'd never met before, but your kind of hand in the darkness for that, that's what I really hope the book to be, and you to connect with others for. And you gave me that, so thank you as well. And the Christmas tree, of course, in the background, which made me cry. I was like, is that a Christmas tree? So I got a tree the next day.
Did you?
Yeah,
I'm
definitely,
glad
straight away. Yeah.
So what was your childhood like?
Oh, okay. Well, My mum actually did experience postnatal depression, which is completely different to postpartum psychosis. Mm-hmm. She got it with my youngest brother, Hector. So I'm the oldest of three. We grew up in Brixton, right by Brixton Prison. In fact, once my dad's scooter was stolen and all the prisoners from the prison was like, they went that way, mate. So it's been a really, really fortunate neighbourhood. But I loved growing up there. I feel like my experience of growing up was, I was so fortunate because I had, my parents were punks, but then my school we were into, had loads of great influence from the bongo players and rap music and poetry. And so I felt really fortunate and kind of, yeah, it was eccentric and wild. And my parents would just make friends of absolutely everybody. We would have people staying in our cramped little flat. It was great. Yeah, and then my mum got postnatal depression, which is really interesting because I'm in the book. I did think a lot about this because there was a big time of my childhood which I don't really remember my mum being there.
Right.
And she was working a lot. She was the one that earned the money in our family. And I remember saying to her once when I was a bit older, being, I don't really remember you, mum, as a child. And that really hurt her. And I was like, well, why does that hurt her? I don't understand. And now, obviously, as an adult, as a mum.
Well, because the book that I'm writing, it's all letters on motherhood. And it's really interesting because obviously you start thinking about your own mum a lot. And, you know, and I found it really surprising how even my mum now cried reading some of the letters, because when she was crying, she said, have I done a good job? Am I a good enough mum? Which broke me because it made me realise that actually throughout this whole journey, we're all going to be having that thought. It never leaves us. So that guilt that we feel now, it's here for the ride.
Isn't it? And it's funny because I was like thinking, I've survived this maternal illness. My son's going to look at me and be like, you're a Wonder Woman, like you're a champion. And I'm like, oh, actually, I have written a whole book about how much she tried to kill me and nearly ruined my entire life. And maybe he's going to have to carry that. And one day he's going to be maybe a 20-year-old man and go, you've just tried to, you know, you've written about me and exploited this whole thing. And
I think he's going to be so proud. I think the knock-on effect, the ripple of this book going out there is going to be huge.
Thank you.
So did you ever think about having a family yourself and what that might look like and being a mum?
Definitely. And I, you always kind of think you're not going to be like your own parents. So like my parents, they love the pub, right? And I now love the pub. And I'd be like, I'm not going to be one of those parents that like, because we would like fall asleep on pub tables and they just sling their leather jackets over us and we'd sleep there. I'd be like, I'm not going to do that yet. Meanwhile, why am I walking down, my baby stealing the bloody balloons off the people's front doors and time to my, just, you turn into your own parent and you think you're not going to when you do. But you know what? I feel like, okay, I wasn't a huge academic when I grew up, but that hasn't stopped me doing something that maybe people would think was a job that was academic. And because I love to tell stories and they encouraged me and let me be exactly what I needed to be. And I feel like that's the true life education. My spelling and grammar at school was atrocious. And I thought I could never be a writer.
We've got editors now.
We've got editors. Thank you.
We've got editors.
And the whole reason why I started telling stories in the first place was because I didn't want anyone to go, you've spelt that wrong or that looks badly. That looks badly. Fine, I'll just say that. And then so that encouragement, self-esteem, that's the most important thing that you can learn, I think, from parents. And that's what I'm trying to just pass on, because look, I ain't good at math, so that's gone.
And you and Hugo, your partner, you met really young.
Yes.
At 14?
14. So I thought he was tiny. I thought he was about 7 years old. I was like, he's not 14. No, he's about seven. And remember just sort of seeing him, his little socks. He was so small and petite and cute. And then he kind of hinted that he thought I was pretty, but I was very a late bloomer in my prettiness and didn't ever feel like that. I was quite happy to be kind of, I was friend zoned all the time, but I would friend zone myself. I wanted to be everyone's mate. I was scared of boobs and things like that. And so I was like, no. Anyway, 10, 15 years later, however long it's been, we finally sorted it out and got together. And which is kind of also why it was so sad with everything that happened and the way it did, because it felt like, oh my God, I'm finally with my dream person. Because we became best friends and we've gone through some of our biggest life things together. My mum remarrying and him losing his mum and his career in the Maccabees and all of that happening. And then we got together and it was this kind of whirlwind of romance. And then it's
so gorgeous the way you write about that time as well, where you're literally like wrapping up in blankets and eating all through the night. It's so romantic.
It became so like nocturnal and fun. And we were using an ironing board as a dining table because we both kind of escaped our long-term setups, and we had both bought houses, and suddenly we didn't, you know, you can't buy a house and then have loads of money in your bank account. We were like, we had an ironing board as our table, two garden chairs for our chairs, borrowed couch, borrowed bed, and we just had the best time ever. And then it really felt like when I got ill that I'd kind of ruined it for everybody. Like, oh, I was like, or maybe felt like also you don't get away with that. You know, you don't get joy like that without suffering at the other end. Like all these kind of negative voices that attack you when you're on your own, those gremlins that have those kind of quiet word of you. And that was a lot of that that all came into play. And I was also writing a teenage book, because I do write for young people mostly, which also, again, added into the, like, Chucky, like, made me feel more mad. I was writing a book about our romance and about young romance, and that sort of fed into it as well, into the psychosis, which we can talk about. But as well, so I'm not writing that anymore because I was just like, this is just too much, too close. So, yeah, it's interesting. It was a good thing and a bad thing. But what was amazing, because we got pregnant so quickly, I think if that
hadn't actually been together that long.
No, we've been together for about 6 months, but we've known each other for so many years that I think if we hadn't have known each other for all that time, if you get a girl pregnant and then she does what I did, you would be like, who the hell is this girl? if she's suggesting that we do a mass suicide, I should probably say there are trigger warnings probably in this. You would be like really seriously freaked out. But he knew me and he was like, this is not Laura, she's ill. And thank goodness for that.
What was it like the moment that you found out you were pregnant?
Amazing. So, you know, actually, I was doing a month vegan and I was like, veganism is really taking its toll. So I'm so tired. I'm so cryy, really missing that cheese. And also I had a spot on my head that looked like I'd been shot, like right there in the center, a crater. And I was like, what is going on? And you have to, I remember I had to do like three because I couldn't wee on the stick. And then in the end, I had to use those little things, you know, that come on the standy uppy toothpaste.
Couldn't wee on the stick.
Well,
couldn't angle.
Couldn't get that nice little side slant. You know, when you get plastic Colgate's, the standy up ones, you get the little plastic shot glass that comes on top. Did it in there, didn't I? All over my hand.
You can't pee on a stick, but you can pee into that tiny little cup.
Yes, it gave me space. Did a little shot glass of the old wee, the old urine. Stuck it in there, didn't I? My sister's on the phone, on speaker. She was like, what are you doing? And I was like, sorry, the phone's, everything's covered in wee.
So no one talks about that, but that part of it.
Your
this
hand
is, a really
is drenched
moment,
in wee.
You're covered in piss.
You're covered in piss. Everything's covered in piss. So, and they're expensive pregnancy tests, which I don't think is okay. And because you think I better go for a clear blue.
I don't like the lines.
I need it to tell me, and I said, you want to go with a trusted brand.
Yeah.
So you think, because I need to know, this is a massive life-changing thing. And it just basically is a metaphor for how expensive the whole thing is going to be.
Yeah,
if you can't afford the pregnancy test, it's an expensive lifestyle.
So your sister was on speakerphone. Yes. Where was Hugo?
Hugo was out, actually, and he was in rehearsal because the Maccabees were doing a final big show at Alexandra Palace and they were all rehearsing. And I called him and I was like, can you come home? And he was like, no, I can't, doing his kind of band thing. And I was like, okay. So I was like, he was like, is everything okay? And I was like, basically, I'm pregnant. So that's what's happened.
He told you on the phone.
Yeah. And he was like, this is him. Okay, then, that's very interesting. Okay, I'll speak to you soon, because he didn't want to say anything to the room. And I was like, okay, that was the most awkward conversation. 2 seconds later, he was like driving back. And he was like, oh, I just said that I didn't feel well. He was like, oh my God, I'm coming back now. So then it all kind of, it was really sweet. And then I did see him do over his shoulder, Googling for like a million years. When it says positive, is it actually 100% positive? Does that mean it's positive? I was like, but he was just... incredible. My pregnancy was a total joy. I felt like, I mean, I don't know how, I think maybe everybody does feel like this to a certain extent, but especially when you're in the arts, you do a little bit feel like a fraud all the time, like you're waiting to get found out. I especially do.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And when I'm on the tube and I'm seeing all these people dressed in their suits, their briefcase, newspapers and coffee, I'm like, oh God, you're a fraud. Just put it all down and just be, let's all just know. Like, this is really difficult. And that, being pregnant, was like the first time I felt legitimate about something, and like it was a fact and no one could take it away from me. And I just did, it felt instinctive. And I was like, I'm not going to let, because don't they love to tell you what to do, everybody? It's like, I'm not going to listen to this. I'm just going to do it how I want to do it. And like, I was always been really scared of the night, like not very good at being on my own. And I really enjoyed like getting up at 2 a.m. because, the, you know, the back pain starts. Yeah. You can't sleep as comfortable, all these things. But I really enjoyed that time watching a film and being with the baby and feeling like this is going to be really exciting. I felt not in a delusional kind of euphoric way, but I did feel like very safe and immune, like people couldn't fall out with you and you can't get a cold and you can't get robbed or attacked, because if someone breaks into your house you're like, I'm pregnant, they're like, oh sorry of course. So I felt really safe. Yeah. And I remember once going on the tube and someone was struggling down the escalators with a baby in a buggy, and I was beaming with my baby on board badge, which you're so, oh, you can't wait to get that, can you? And this woman said to me, they're better in than out. And I was like, all right, sourpuss. And I'm like, okay, now I'm that woman.
Although I do think that with the badge and when you're pregnant, everyone, they can't do enough for you. When the baby's actually there, it does feel a bit like, oh God, that baby. You know,
absolutely.
Oh God, here they come.
Completely.
It's so weird, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when you're... This is one of the other things. Why on the buggy don't they put a nice soft squidgy bit for you to help carry the buggy down? You're not cutting your fingers off on stairs.
Yeah.
And of course it's for health. You're not meant to be clanging down
stairs. That's true.
Stairs.
Don't encourage it.
But oh my God, it's painful.
Yeah.
I've got a few design ideas as well.
How did you feel going into the labour? Like, did you worry about what was coming? Were you quite relaxed?
So I was 2 weeks overdue. And I was very small, showing really small. And people kept telling me, everybody, and I have, I'm really close with lots of my neighbours. I've got lots of amazing women that live near me, old women. And all of them kept being like, not minding, going, you're very small. You're showing very small. And I was like, oh. My mum reassured, you know, everyone was going, don't worry, it's fine. But I do remember a lot of people saying, your nose hasn't bloated. Your nose hasn't bloated. And you sort of, what do you mean? You're not, this is the thing. It's like people sprouting feathers, turning into a chicken. Yeah, that means you're ready to give birth, all these kind of things. And 2 weeks overdue, my waters hadn't broken.
Your nose looked the same.
My nose was exactly the same. And you kind of are waiting. You feel cheated from the beginning because you watched Look Who's Talking and all these films and you want that big splatter of the theatre of the waters breaking and it never comes. And I remember on the day I actually had him, or the day before I had him, I went to hospital, I went for a run. Like, and I remember just being like, I feel like I could go nightclubbing. Like, I feel...
Are you a runner? Did you
energized.
Run?
Now we can talk about my true love exercise in a bit. But at this point, I'm ish running. But the fact that I wanted to do that, where most women that I know would be like, God, you can't move. It's really painful. You know, like a teapot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not like that. And
right.
So that was my first kind of thought. It was Valentine's Day. And I remember I was bouncing on one of these yoga balls, thinking that any sort of hunger grumble was a pregnancy, you know, contraction or something, watching The Office. And then we were kept calling, can we come into the hospital? And they wanted to give me a pessary, which is like a hormonal tampon.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly thought they'd be giving that to me and then I'd be coming back out, but then they didn't let me go. They were like, you're 2 weeks overdue, we need to get this baby out, the waters could have broken and then you can get infection and all the rest of it. So I was like, okay, well, yeah, that, we don't want that to happen, kind of thing. But I remember looking in the corridor thinking, everyone else looks really pregnant and I don't. And everyone wants their baby on Valentine's Day for some weird reason. And I'm just like, yeah, but are we 2 weeks? Come on, it's not a hotel in Paris. Like, this is life and death. I remember just feeling really scared. Like, I want to get out of here. I don't want to be in here because I don't feel... It felt like someone was going, okay, we're going to take out a lung now. Like, everyone kept going, at 40 weeks, you'll be desperate to get this thing out of you. I didn't feel like that.
Mm.
So it was all very scary. And I was at the hospital where I had my first ever panic attack.
And you've never, ever had a panic attack or experienced anything?
No. And it was just like extreme. Speaking now to friends, and I'm now the most annoying person in the world. I talk about mental health nonstop. Mm-hmm. I am the postpartum psychosis. Mother Noose, I call myself, instead of Mother Goose. but now when people tell me the physical symptoms of panic attacks, actually mine was very mild and So I feel fortunate
but
still for that.
But if it's you're going through something massive, it's your first ever experience of it, it's really difficult to then compare what other people have. Like, sure. It's all relative to you.
Absolutely. And you're completely right. But so I guess from what I'd heard of panic attacks, of this kind of the pressing on your chest and the fire and all these things, I did have inklings of that, but not, you know, I could still function, which I was good. It was really scary, and I just remember seeing this clear basin where the baby was meant to go, and I was like, how am I meant to fill that thing with the baby? Because then, in all honesty, I don't, if someone told me now, it's, you're unpunked, it's all a joke, you know, I actually got, I would have gone, yeah, probably, okay. And then that bloody tampon thing just fell out of me like a dead mouse. I thought, this hasn't done anything at all, just plopped on the floor, nothing was happening. And then suddenly it was shark attack. It felt just like, it's emergency. We think he's small. Every time you're contracting, which was still in the early stages, he was going underneath. His blood pressure and heartbeat wasn't keeping up with mine. So they were like kind of describing it like that he was going underwater and it was taking him longer to kind of come back out. And then someone along the line mentioned and said, I think you've got a small baby. Has anyone mentioned preeclampsia to you? Which nobody had mentioned that, or should have been a high risk pregnancy. And then they kept saying a small baby. And I was like, what do you mean by a small baby? Kind of imagine this like Tom Thumb little. And I went on this massive rant about how even if whatever the problem was, I, you know, I'm still so happy. I just want to get him
out
safely.
You literally are in that moment, because you are glossing over it, but you literally did think like a little person, like Tom Thumb.
I my brain went to these. No one was explaining what a small baby meant. So I just kind of was going with what everyone was, so I was kind of running through all
taking
these what-if scenarios.
Yeah.
Also, in the world of science, you kind of think people don't really, they're not exaggerators like us lot, are they? They're talking very factual. So I was like, right, well, I'll get ready for my Channel 4 dispatches. This is going to be my moment. But then they're kind of rushing you along to they move you to like a bit, it's still in the ward, but it's like closer to where the doctors are. So they can keep a closer eye on you. And then they basically explained to me, which already, as if you don't have enough mother's guilt to look forward to, that he had been starving in my womb. So he had once been a big, fat, chubby, prized pumpkin, but the longer I'd gone over, my placenta had failed, so he wasn't getting the nutrients that he needed, and he'd actually shrunk. So when he came out, he was tiny, but he had extra sort of skin where you could see he'd once been fat and then lost the weight. He came out, he wasn't too bad, he came out just under 5 pounds, but he was hungry.
That was
the beginning.
You ended up having an emergency C-section, didn't
emergency
you?
Cesarean and epidural as well. Bloody lovely, nice bubble bath for the old organs. But you know, I sort of remember levitating, like not in a delusional way, but I remember handing myself over. I was such a passenger in my labour, which is the thing that I'm most annoyed about. I was so going to everybody, are you okay? Sorry that I'm so difficult. I'm sorry. Have you had time to eat? Like those kind of things. Sorry that this is so, which I'm annoyed at myself about. I can't regret it, but I sort of feel like an 80s movie in like Ghost or something. I sort of remember going, this is just too much. Things just kept going wrong over and over. I just couldn't handle it. I've been really fortunate that I've never had to go to hospital properly before. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of went. I just remember going, this is too much. I'm going to shut myself down. And probably, I mean, they're now working with Action on Postpartum Psychosis, who's the amazing organisation that helps survivors. We do call ourselves survivors. A lot of women have felt that the symptoms come on during labour, and I wonder if it is in that kind of handing over where it's just too traumatic. But people do that in trauma, don't they? Some people freeze, some people can't, you can escape your body, and maybe that saved me as well.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I remember one part of the book where you're in labor, where that's you're in the hospital. And there was a, you say that you want your mum, and there's a part a few pages later where she arrives.
Oh God, yeah.
I literally wept so much. Just that safety, almost. You kind of like revert back to needing someone.
Yeah. It's funny because in the long, long version, which I mean, you still read a really good version, so thank you so much. But I actually say when I write that, that like, I just can't, I stop writing because I'm just crying. Yeah, so what happened was I just, my family were all waiting for me, for the baby. They knew I'd gone in and I hadn't text back. And I just remember grabbing my phone at one point. This is when I was in epidural. They tried to let me sleep. They turned the lights down and it was just me and this one midwife. I'd sent Hugo out. Hugo's terrified of hospitals. Also, he's a vape addict. He was just there chugging away outside. You kind of get this instinct where you want to be like a cat and just like give birth in an airing cupboard on your own without anyone around and scream and sweat and piss and poo like a rhino without anyone watching you because it's so, you've got self-conscious like... We're so in London and England, we're so, you know, we don't even like getting our bodies out on the beach. So then suddenly you've gone from that to like, rah,
and well, there's something so vulnerable about giving birth.
So vulnerable and scary.
You're so exposed, yeah.
Yes, the lights were really low and it was just me and this one midwife, and I'd had a million midwives by this point. So I remember just being desperate to try and build a connection with one of them to try and be my wingwoman, be my cheerleader. Yeah, and then I just text my mum just saying, am I going to be okay, mum? And then there was a knock at the door moments later, and then it was my mum. She was actually Pokemoning for a lot of it.
Oh, was it during that phase where everyone had the app?
During that phase. She's still in that phase. She is a full-blown... I'm like, where are you, mum? I'm in Margate trying to catch a Snorlax, whatever the hell she's doing. So at this point, yeah, she just comes and she did have all these bags of like sweaty hummus and mackerel pate, all the things you do not want when you're in the hospital. Yeah. But yeah, she smelled of home, like of I remember the fire of the dogs of and you know, because I had just handed myself over in this way, I think it was I also really wanted her to leave because I didn't want her seeing me being like that. No one wants their mum to see. And maybe that is part of being a mum, is also looking to your own mum like you're really strong and you can do this. And that's one of the really tough bits about it. But also wanting her to leave because I'd already felt like I was such a nuisance to the staff. By no fault of my own. I mean, I'm the biggest goody-goody. I did everything I was told to do and in my recovery, which is why I do think I've got better. But... I just felt like, I'm sorry that my mum's here and my mum's such a character and she's bought all this food and she's playing Pokemon and I'm so sorry. But like at the same time, I didn't really feel like I knew her anymore actually because I felt so different, I think. I felt like I'd changed actually at that moment.
Literally.
Yeah. And I didn't know when I was going to come back.
In what way do you feel like you changed?
Oh, I was just like scary, I think. That's what's so horrible about getting ill in the way that I have, is that you feel scary. And I think everyone has in their mind a version of what a mentally ill person looks like, a vulnerable person looks like, someone who's got the word psychosis attached to them, or you have these blurred kind of jagged images of, you know, women having electric shock therapies. Mm. Always women, actually, yeah. for me. People contorting or crucifixes, all these crazy paraphernalia, which is a tabloid extreme version. And then it happens to you and you're like, oh my God, that person, that image that I had, which is very American Horror Story and cinema, you're no different from that. You're just a person and you're really, really vulnerable, and we all are, and the spectrum is so vast and we're all on it. And I think I had in my mind, you know, before, I would have maybe have been one of those people that thought, okay, so you're watching a nature program and you might see an animal reject their young and you're shouting at the TV and you're like, feed your baby, what the hell? You see, it's really sad, the hippo isn't bonding with their baby or whatever, and then it happens to you and you're that animal and you think, oh my God. And it's not because you're a cruel, mean Lady Macbeth person. It's you're just so scared. Nobody is more scared of you than you.
Mm. It's interesting you used the word scary when you first said it. You found yourself scary.
Oh my God, yeah. Because inside me, sometimes I still check for it. It's so weird. If I have like a bad moment, like a weird moment, I will look in the mirror and I'm looking for it, like just looking for one glimmer of it, which
like,
is
like it's a physical thing.
Like it's a physical thing. Because I could hit, I mean, we, I don't know, we're, I mean, we try, how can we have an order of these things? Yeah, I mean, well, how do you talk about those things? But because I did hear voices, which again is a thing, it's like I'm not hearing voices, but then you sit there and you think, what is that? Does that count as hearing a voice in the same way that does wishing that someone would kill you count as a suicidal thought? Wishing you get hit by a train, you're not planning to kill yourself, but you are still thinking that you wish your life was over. Is that a suicidal thought? And hearing a voice, it's like hearing something come and shoot into your head that is not something, it's not an intrusive thought. You're not going, oh, imagine if I threw myself in front of the train tracks. It's something more than that, like, but it isn't the voice of Stephen Fry or David Attenborough. Yeah. Does that count then as hearing a voice? All these things. When you then look in yourself and you think, wow, okay, there's something else in there that isn't me. But it is you. It's like you're the killer and also you're the victim of you. Yeah. The whole thing is mad. It literally is mad.
What was it like when you first heard Jet?
He came out in the cesarean and they threw it, like thrust him up to the in the air in that kind of Simba way. But he was like horrible. He was like long and so skinny and goblin-y and angry at me, like really angry. They scratched his head in the breaking of the waters. So his head was covered in blood. And he was really stressed in labour, so there was meconium, which is when they poo inside you. The cord had been wrapped around his neck twice. He was facing the wrong way. Obviously, he'd been starving for 2 weeks. All you want as a woman is to have this womb that is something you don't have to think about, but is that cosy and squishy and safe, this sanctuary for growing. And I felt like it was this horrible dungeon. And I just felt like this kid is livid at me and I've got a lot of making up to do to prove to him that I can make this better. And yeah, they kind of thrust him in the sky and I just remember Hugo's face was just there and we just both looked up and we were just like, oh. What are we gonna do? And then they said it was fine, that he actually is really good. He, you know, they do that little point thing at the end. They're like, he scored really high on his points, he's just got to be fed up. And then I don't know what point you think, oh, now I can just have a can of Sprite and chill, because no, it's like this baby is thrust onto you. And they did not underestimate when they said how hungry he actually was. So he fed for 24 hours. One day, because I had to stay in this ward. If you've stayed in a ward, anybody listening, you'll know. I know that the NHS are doing their very, very, very best. And we're stretched. But it's a really difficult place to live, but like practically, but also you're going through the most intimate, vulnerable part of your life. You're trying to fall in love with a million people watching you. The temperature is extraordinarily high. A lot of babies in there are premature, have low blood sugar, so everyone, you know, of course it's lovely that we are kept warm, but it's hot. Then you're sharing beds with a ward with lots of other women who, and they don't want you to put the curtains around you. I'm not sure where that is actually, but you're not allowed your curtains around you in the day. So, and even if you are, every so often the women are just, the midwives are thrashing the curtains open, injecting you or fixing your catheter, which I didn't even know I even had one. Second, I was like, I haven't weed for, oh, okay, weed's just there.
There's my weed.
Weed's just in a parcel. And then there's lots of men around, of course, because they're having babies too. And you don't want your boobs out. Breastfeeding is not easy. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to do that. I've had a cesarean. Everything is everywhere. You can't get crumbs under you and blankets, and you can't. I remember it just gave up at one. Oh, also a rare symptom of the epidural, a side effect is that you can get itchiness. Of course, I got that as well, but I couldn't itch my holding my tiny baby. He will not get off my boob. So I'm scratching with my feet. I've got these ugly stockings on. My legs are like the leg of a goth. You know, I'm like, everything's happening. I'm scratching my feet. It's like raw blood everywhere, basically. And he just won't get off me. And it's like, and you just want to sleep because mm-hmm. you haven't, and you've gone through all this trauma that I just described to you. And you're not sleeping anyway before you have a baby, especially when you're overdue and you're the anxiety, but also you can't find comfort. So you just run ragged. And then all, it's like a horrible carousel of hell, basically, where the babies are taking turns to scream each other's heads off and the mums are then crying. So everyone's just crying but taking different turns. So there's just no peace in there. We were there for a week. And yeah, at one point I caught my feeding notes and I'd fed for 18 hours straight with a 10-minute break and then another 8 hours. And I just remember thinking, looking back, I was just like, that's actually insane. And everyone contradicts themselves because all the midwives are on shift. So they'll come in and they'll say, what are you doing swaddling him? He's not meant to be swaddled. Put him on his front, put him on his side, put him on his back. Try the rugby ball position. Have you not done that? And then it's amazing because you are getting a crash course in motherhood. And these women have come from all around the world.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? So everyone, no matter if they're a mum or a midwife, whoever, everyone has different ways of doing it and different methods.
Completely.
And they all feel like because it's worked for them, it's going to work for you. So they'll all pay it forward. But in that paying it forward, it becomes really overwhelming.
Exactly. And in some way, it's amazing because you think, oh my God, like these women, this is nothing to them. This is just another day at the office, which is really nice. The same way you see a turbulent, you know, air stewardess in turbulence and you think, they look chill, I'm going to be chill. Seeing them kind of not be stressed, you're like, okay, fine. When you're talking to a mama that's had like 5 kids or whatever, fine. But it is also, as you say, anxiety inducing and some, you know, will tell you off of various things. So you can't sleep with them on you. They don't. You can only put them down in this basin. They don't want to be in this basin. And also, I don't blame Jet, my son, like looking back, if you'd been in that condition, you'd want to be with your mum and feel safe and warm and giving milk. But also it's demand and supply, right? Mm-hmm. So they are drinking to try and make the milk come. He's starving. When you've had a cesarean, it takes longer for the milk to actually come. So he's working really hard at getting this milk. So it was a lot. And he's so small, you know. Oh, he had to have this red hat as well. Like red hat babies, they're called, which is when they're babies that have to have special care. We weren't in intensive care, but just one little bit above. It was all about his blood sugars, basically, keeping his blood sugars up. Otherwise, it's just everything as well. If this doesn't work, brain damage. If that doesn't work, paralyzed. Like constant, everything's big threat.
How did it feel though when you were told you were going home?
Look, I was like, this is it now. It's going to all be fine. It's going to be the Walt Disney castle. I'll be fine. Jet will be fine. Everything will be fine. He screamed the whole way back. I knew we'd been there for a long time because even the parking person was just like, do you know what? Just pay half because this has been extreme. We went home. He screams the whole way and your mind is going, it must be the temperature. It must be the sun. Like maybe the sun's in his eyes. It's all new. Got home, all got into the bed. I thought, finally, now we can just be warm. I had this plan.
And that is the picture, isn't it, that you see that you're going to have when you get home. All of you together in bed, snuggled up. Isn't it lovely?
That's what they say as well. They go, just get naked and roll around. And it's like, yeah, don't you think that's what I want to do? Like, not be in this app. We lie in bed, basically. And I just remember, you know that feeling before school when you're little on a Sunday night, London's burning on, whatever, heartbeat. And you're just like, I feel doom and dread and like just sick about the next day. It's just that times a million, like something's not right. Why is Hugo just straight away bam snoring away? I'm like, how can you sleep? Like, what's just happened to us? I've slept in clubs before. I've fallen asleep at Glastonbury standing up. Like, I have no trouble sleeping. Suddenly I'm just like, something really bad is going to happen and I can't put my finger on it, but I just don't feel normal. So I said to Hugo, something's wrong. He's like, what's wrong? Nothing's wrong. We're all fine. Everything's fine. I'm like, it's not. And then it just escalated really quickly.
Really?
Yeah. Within like days. Yeah. It was just, well, that feeling never left. It followed me around for a long time. And then everybody was called Laura suddenly. Like, so Hugo would be watching Derren Brown or something and be like, using the contestant, Laura. And I'd be like, you know, sometimes you hear your name in the theatre and you think nothing of it. Yeah, you might stick with it and then you go, oh. But then it was like everybody was called Laura. I was suddenly started looking for meanings in songs. And but I just want to say, I've never experienced like poor mental illness before. Yeah. So this is just, okay. And I know already there's a strong, I don't enjoy drug. I love a glass of wine, but I'm not a drug taker. So I don't like being out of my body.
Yeah.
So very quickly I had a rational thought going, this is alarm bells and I'm not enjoying this one bit. Who would, but really wasn't.
When your midwife came over.
Yeah.
That was quite an experience at first. So you are feeling all of this, mm-hmm. that something's not right. Uh-huh. But what did you do before the midwife came over?
Yeah, well, I cleaned the house spotless and then I put on a full face of makeup and this like really peachy orange fluffy jumper that made me think I look like the mother from heaven. And then I basically was like, maybe I should bake brownies. Maybe I should, like, really intense. I'd started writing everything down in a notebook and making Hugo write it down when, because of Jet's low weight, he had to be fed every 3 hours. So people say never wake a sleeping baby. Mm. Everyone does it their own way and yeah. lovely, but I had to stick to this alarm system. So throughout the night, the plan was I feed left breast, whatever, right breast, then go to sleep and then set the alarm for another 3 hours. He had to be on. But you have to set the alarm at the beginning of the first yeah. feed. So it's a complete trap because yeah. sometimes it takes 2 hours to do the feed.
Yeah.
But I'm writing it all down, the poos and the... Because that's the only way you know the food's getting into them, right? So I'm writing all of this down. It's like the scrawlings of an insane train spotter, like a stalker, basically. And I kind of show it really proudly to my midwife, like, look at what I've made. And she was not impressed. She was like, okay, it's nice to have an idea, but, you know, don't go overboard. And that I remember being livid. Like, I've gone to all this effort. And I remember just, I had classical music on. It was horrible. Mm. And as soon as I shut the door, I just remember my face just, like, turning off.
Right.
Being like, well, you know, like, okay, going back to, horrible. Yeah, just, like, wipe all that makeup off. Because like, all my other friends are like, what? If the midwife comes over, you don't know when they're going to, because they never tell you when they're coming, do they? Yeah. So it's like, you know, you're washing everywhere and food and takeaway. It's like people were sending me cards and flowers and I was just didn't want anything.
You got
Hugo
to get rid of everything?
Everything. I just said, throw all of this out. This is not a celebration to me, which was really sad because I have the most lovely friends and people from my public, people that I didn't even hadn't seen for years had sent such beautiful things. And I just one day said to you, I just want everything gone. And he said, it's a celebration. I was like, it's not to me. This is...
Why didn't you feel it was a celebration?
Because I was gone. I was just like, I'm dead now inside. And I was so set on killing myself that I didn't think I was going to be around anyway. So I was just like, people would probably describe me as like before that as a really happy person and naturally happy, almost fake that I was that happy. And now I was just the opposite of that. Just when people say a shell, I never understood that, but that is how I felt, just a shell. And then the suicidal thought went from something that had to happen to like, no, it had to happen. It was then becomes like a craving.
Can you remember the first time you had that thought?
Well, it was to do with when I first heard the voice, because that I was changing Jet's nappy, and he was only a couple of weeks old, and I was with Hugo, and I just heard this voice go to me, something really fucking bad is about to happen, something really fucking bad. And I remember just being like, oh, it was horrible. It was my own voice. It was really weird, but not my own voice. Right. And I just said to Hugo, can you just take over changing jet? I walked down the hallway and it just kind of came with me, like, what do you think you're going to do? Like, do you think you're going to try and get... It kind of holds you like how an abuser would, you know, and makes you feel like if you tell anybody about it, it's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. So I remember going straight to the bathroom and looking in the mirror for... telling you, like, you know, I was saying earlier, kind of looking for it, and it just looked back at me, and it was kind of like a he sort of thing, like a hi. And I just remember being like, oh my god. And actually I think it was a rational part of my brain that wanted to kill myself at first, because it was like, I have seen films and read books, I know where this goes, and it's not a good place, and I don't know what it's going to make me do, where it's going to take me, and I'm so scared. I just would rather get this out of the way. A bit like, I'm like that in hide and seek when I was little. I'd be like, just catch me really quickly. I don't like waiting to be caught. Please just catch me. That's what it was like. I was like, I just want to just make this over, because there's no coming back from it. I'm so mad. There's no coming back from it.
And you felt that Jet would be better off.
Oh my God. Yeah, I was like, you start to think like, and it's catastrophizing, that's all it is, but you start to think that you're going to go down this really horrible route and you're going to become something really terrifying and dangerous, or like a kind of zombie eating apple crumble in a hospital somewhere, and that's going to be your child's life. And it's horrible.
Yeah. How was Hugo in that time? Did you voice any of this to him?
Well, it all seems so insane. Someone bought us a sick... By the way, I use these words like mad and insane and all these things because that's the only way I can think of to describe it. And in school, they don't teach you the vocabulary, the language to describe these words. So I'm really sorry for some people find those offensive. But for me, I don't. That's how I can translate to you how I feel. What was I saying?
You were going to say about the bear.
Yeah, about the bear. Oh my God, you knew it. Someone bought us a 6-foot bear. Someone who obviously must not have a child, because why would you buy anybody that anyway? Ugly thing.
And he's thanks, mate.
Ugly thing. He's one of my mum's friends. This giant bear shows up and Hugo's like, whoa, I don't really like this bear. Mm. He's massive. But I was so trying to prove to the rest of the world that I was fine. I was like, I love it. So this bear sits there and we take pictures of a jet or everything, and the bear's just, in my mind, just staring at me in those really horrible, shiny, plasticky eyes. Hey, filming me, got CCTV in there, or is alive in some way. And I just had to do everything I couldn't just not to rip it apart. So things like that, I was like, I can't tell Hugo that, because he's gonna then be really freaked out by me and scared of me. I'd seen this play as well when I was pregnant called Yerma, which has a really dark ending if you know the play. I don't want to give it away, because it's an amazing play. And my friend actually is acting in it as well. So anyway, the ending is really scary. And I felt like I was connected to the play and that I had to follow through with the play, which is so, it's like anxiety, but it's like a kind of OCD thing as well, which is why once your head is cracked, all of these illnesses that you once seemed so far away from you seem so close. You understand them. Not you don't ever understand them, but you feel... okay, I thought people were alcoholics because they just really enjoyed getting drunk. Yeah. And it's not that. It's a trap. Mm-hmm. So now I see that. I'm like, oh, okay.
Your family basically moved in as well.
It became like Glastonbury at my house. And then I was on complete suicide watch. If I was in the toilet for a second, my sister would like high kick the door down. But I was bleeding at the same time. So had to keep changing these pads. You know what that bit's like. So you'd hear like a rustling of that. And then... So I kept being given new drugs from the GP to help me sleep. That was also safe to take breastfeeding. Breastfeeding was the only thing I could do. So one of the drugs I was given was a drug called quetiapine, which is a drug that is treats schizophrenia. I've taken in a high dose, but a really low dose is safe to take as whilst feeding and can be used as a sleeping aid. But the doctor, for example, had said to Hugo, don't worry, Laura, but it is... this is before they knew of postpartum psychosis, and my diagnosis had come to, everyone was saying, is it baby blues or struggling to adjust? Sleep will sort me out. And she said, this drug is actually used to treat schizophrenia. But that was it. My brain had kind of wrapped around it like a snake would a mouse and gone, that's it. I've got schizophrenia. I've had schizophrenia the whole time. But honestly, you could have told me I was a crisp at that time and I would have gone, I'm a crisp. So, because that's what the brain, it's like Velcro. It's the oddest thing. Because when I was in the hospital, I would hear this psychiatric ward. I once overheard a woman say she thought she was dead. And I was like, oh, yeah, we're all dead. Like, it's just the oddest thing.
Well, so 6 days before you went into hospital, you took a photo of yourself and posted it online where you were out, mum life, kind of had a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And you posted it. Your makeup was done.
Yeah.
And it was like everything was rosy.
Yeah. I said, hello, world. I'm a mum. It took me about an hour to even write those words because my brain was just a mess. But so Hugo and I had gone for this lunch. My dad was going to watch the baby. I remember my dad's partner saying, you've taken to this like a duck to water. And I just remember being like, and that voice is there going, don't tell them what's going on inside. Don't tell them, don't tell them. It's going to get worse if you tell anybody. I remember my dad saying, do you need anything? And I was like, yeah, paracetamol. It's like, yeah, I need like a gun or something. Like, need to get out of here. We go to this restaurant and I'm thinking, it's like an alien has hijacked my body. So I'm in my head going, what would Laura order? What would Laura order? It, like, pretend to the world you're her, but she's gone now kind of thing. Posted that thing, which is why I wanted to address it, because I was like, I've done exactly what I'm so terrified. I've just creating more of the stigma and everyone going, way, God, now she's a writer and she's a... you know, God, she's got a baby, she's got a boyfriend. It's like the
things. And I think if we're all told all the time that motherhood is amazing and that's the only thing that we're ever told about it, I think that's the part that's tough. Because actually when you do have a baby and actually it's really hard and difficult, you feel like you're the only one experiencing it. And a lot of what you wrote in the book, so many mums will experience.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously it goes to the extremes and depths where other, like a lot haven't, but there's so much that is relatable. I think it's important that we,
which is why it's so hard to be diagnosed, right?
Yeah.
Because everyone's going, I remember just getting anyone's number I could that had a baby and being like, I wish I had your number, you probably would have said fine, but people would just be like, yeah, that's normal, it passes, oh don't worry about that, yes, completely normal. It's like, do you find you can't sleep even when the baby's sleeping? Do you feel nervous and scared all the time, like everyone's watching you, or like you don't love your own baby? Yeah, of course I do.
And you felt that weeks after.
Oh yeah. And everyone was just going, yeah, that's normal. So I was like, okay, just ride it out.
What was it like when did your family sit you down and say that they were taking you to hospital?
No, the only time I was properly sat down properly was to take my first antidepressant. I don't even like taking the paracetamol. And then it was this moment where it was like my mum and dad together, who are not together and rarely in the same room, had come together and they were like, Laura, take the pill. And I was like, and that's when I knew. But at this point I was so, my everything felt static and charged. Mm. Even an action like for putting my hair behind my ear felt like really staged and huge, and I just felt like I was Alice in Wonderland in this, just massive, and all my actions were really exaggerated. So that I was like, okay, I know I'm definitely gone there. But the day of my it was an intervention, but it wasn't with my side of the family, it was with Hugo's family, which most people don't even want their partner's dad to see them in a towel, and I'm there like literally losing the plot in front of them. I'm by now it's getting really, really heavy. It's
you have a man's voice by this
book.
Point as well.
I don't actually, I'm terrified of hearing a man's voice.
Right.
Someone has said to me, do you hear a man's voice? And then I'm going, oh, the man's voice is coming.
Right.
Yeah. Luckily it didn't get to that, but I become so terrified of hearing that. At this point, it's all mixed up in Hugo's trauma with losing his mum. That kind of plays out into my psychosis. I start to believe that I'm obsessed person. I was obsessed with Hugo my whole life, and I'd wanted to get to this, and everybody knew it, and I'd been revealed, and I was a master of the dark arts. And I remember my sister got driven, it was 1 a.m. on a Saturday, it was Mother's Day, one in the morning on the Sunday, so Saturday night. Yeah, and then driven through central London. I didn't know where I was going. I remember thinking all these things. Was it prison? Was it rehab? I didn't know. And then I kind of got there and I was like, this is not a normal hospital. Then I was like, this is an experiment. Everyone's in on it. It's a complete conspiracy. Just deep paranoia, extreme paranoia. And then I remember the nurse coming out and my sister going, she looks like J-Lo.
And then feeling like, okay, maybe it's going to be all right
because J-Lo's looking after me.
J-Lo's here.
What was it like when you realised that you're actually on a psychiatric ward?
Well, they put me through to this room, which I didn't realise was going to be my bedroom. And they sat me on a bed. They wanted to interview me right there and then in the night. And I was like, can't I just sleep? I just kept saying, please just give me... I hadn't slept by now, in all honesty, for probably nearly a month.
Right.
Maybe an hour here or there. And I was just like, just give me what the fattest thing you've got that's going to just knock me out. And they were like, we can, but we need to talk to you. And I guess now looking back, they probably wanted to talk to that version of me. Right. So they probably knew these fears and what... Looking back over them, they're very innocent. One of my fears was Streatham.
The place?
The place, Streatham. Straight up Streatham. Still scared of Streatham. Hugo was like, that's completely normal. It's like, oh, yeah, Streatham's, that's right. Streatham is scary.
Don't worry, that's rational.
So I told them, I remember though, I was slurring my words. Like, I couldn't speak. Like, I was literally like, to even get out what I wanted to say. I don't know if it was the tiredness or the power of my, how hard it, my brain was working. And then they said, they asked me, had I planned anything? And I was like, planned anything? And then I was like, oh, you're talking about suicide. And so then...
Your dad was in your in the room when...
Not at this point, right. The next day. This was Hugo and Daisy in the room, and they... I asked them to leave, basically, because I... The way I wanted to kill myself was really traumatic and horrible. And I was going to do it in the park, which was like really, because I didn't want to do it in the house. There was these things I just wanted to just say without them hearing. And they, now hearing from them, they were like, we were just in this communal kitchen, just hugging each other, crying, like, which was just a whole thing. So they kept me up till about, I think, 3 a.m. It was like a really... I mean, amazing, intensive chat. They were, they knew loads. They asked me if I was prone to taking drugs when I was stressed or overworked. Or no history of mental illness and all the rest of it. And then I was put to sleep. And then just waking up that next morning was just like nothing else. That was just when I imagine taking every drug and drink in the world and waking up with that beer fear times a million and thinking that's why it's called it was just what have I done. I just remember waking up in this hospital, the first thing I see was the door ajar and a nurse's eye just watching me. I didn't know where I was, what was going on, and there were some scrambled eggs or something, I think. Yeah, and then I kind of just shuffled across in my... I just didn't even want the nurse to... You wouldn't have recognized my gait, my way, everything. Depression and anxiety completely changes your physicality. It's an all-consuming illness. And then it was about just finding my bearings. And I was admitted to general psych. So it was schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, alcoholism, eating disorder. So I was surrounded by people that didn't have the same illness as me. And not necessarily the physical illnesses. So everything was so confusing. But so my milk was still coming. I was still bleeding. I had cesarean, like... So physically as well, I was struggling, but...
What's it like now, looking back? Because obviously you've had to go there so much and so deep writing the book. What is it like?
I've heard of this form of therapy. I'm not exactly sure what it's called, but where you talk about something, a trauma, over and over and over again, and it actually... This is a really great thing about talking about it, because you actually do get a bit bored of it eventually. It's like when you talk about fancying a boy and then you kind of look back and you're like, God, I actually really fancied you. I don't know why, because you're just not that great. That's a little bit like what it's like with this. I've managed through talking about it and through sharing it, because depression loves to think it has you cornered. And the only proper thing you can do to... not fight depression, because I think fight's the wrong word, but to live alongside depression, anxiety, and to not let it scare you, is to be open about it and go, I'm not going to let you corner me. I'm going to, like a bully, like a school bully, and just go, I've let everyone know that you're trying to get me, but it's not going to happen.
Well, it was only 6 months after Jet was born that you wrote a blog for Clemmie Telford.
Yeah.
Who you'd known anyway, because you had babies due around the same time.
Yeah.
And so she obviously got in touch.
I'd met her once, yeah. And then I just said, I'm ready to... I'd written this thing on my phone. I was like, I want to share it. But I woke up the next... Oh, I didn't even sleep, I don't think. Within the next day, again, all those... Not the voice, but the anxiety of these gremlins and monsters were just all around me, like, what do you think you're going to do? Go on bloody Strictly Come Dancing for postpartum psychosis? all these sort of things. And then I was like, oh my God, because then we got completely overwhelmed with TV requests, media requests. And then as a writer, that's all you want is your words to connect. And suddenly it is connected, and it was in this kind of Faustian way where it was like, I had to pay for that. In my physical health for me and my son and Hugo. And I was just like, ran away. And then I fell into a depression after that. And then again, through CBT, which is my number one boyfriend, and talking and lifting weights. I'm strong.
Is that what your exercise is now?
Oh my God, I'm obsessed with lifting weights. But yesterday I went to the gym and I was lifting weights and actually cried because we, this all coming to a close now. So the book's just about to go off. You read like a pre-proof, but the proof's coming out next week. And it's more, I don't allow myself much time for self-pity because I do find that staggers me if I think too much about what happened to us. I feel really sad for us.
Do you feel like that time was robbed from you?
Yeah, I do. And now my sister's had a baby and seeing her breastfeeding and having that time, and I'm not, there's 50% chance of me getting it again. So watching her, I feel so, it's so beautiful, and I'm such a proud auntie. I'm also like, thank God I've got postpartum psychosis to blame on the fact I'm never going to do that again. Thank God for that.
Really?
But also like, oh, that is really nice and amazing. And I've had to see it as a three. We don't really do in our house like mum, dad, baby too much. I feel we're a complete three, and Jet relies on Hugo for milk and his cuddles just as much as me. And not many dads or partners that don't do the birthing always get that. They sometimes have to take a back seat. Don't feel like it, but you know what, was over so quickly. But I remember my mum saying, like, you threw yourself at that recovery. And I actually did, like, anything I could do to get better, I did, and more. And I made that like my, I could do anything if I worked as hard at anything I did as this, as we're getting better for this. But this, it's a weird paradox, because Jet is what, not caused this illness, it's not Jet's fault, but having Jet is what made this happen, was the trigger. But also nothing makes you save your own life than watching a little baby be like, I need my mum. And you are just like, I'm going to live every single day for you.
Is it scary having seen yourself like that and having seen what madness is?
Yes, having a peek. Ooh. Going, well, that was interesting. Trying to feel the door and the door's not opening, and you're like, okay, I'm locked in here now. I'm locked. But you know, I've learned so much, because my fears now, they've diminished. Like those big fears that I had before, ghosts. What the hell? I was scared of ghosts so much, like 2 years ago, the dark. What if? I'm like, go on then, ghost. Because when you've done this, I always wanted to be a strong woman when I was little. I was like, I want to be a Spice Girl, all these things. Like, and now
you're better than a Spice
now
Girl.
I'm like, actually, I'm a strong woman. Something really massive's happened to me, and I actually aced it.
You totally did. One thing that, you know, worried you at first, because you didn't feel that bond, and you for weeks. How is that bond now?
Oh my God, we are so tight. We're just like, oh, I can't. Yeah, now I say it in the book, but it's true. You think you make your baby, but they make you. Like, he made me. And actually, him giving me this illness has made me such a more effective person. I feel like I'm a better friend. I feel more plugged into the world, more empathetic, and taking life with a lightness, actually, and a heaviness at the same time, which is, I'm deaf of the small talk. I'm willing to go there with people, because actually this is the big stuff. You pick up anybody's biography, famous, not famous, you stand next to any bus stop, even in this room, this building, everyone is going through or has gone or will go through something that will change them forever and make them who they are. And that's a really enriching and reassuring thing. Take comfort in that you're not on your own.
What was Jet's first word?
Mama. Now I wear my mum ring, so yeah, I'm legit now.
So my next book is all about letters, letters on motherhood. If you could write a letter on motherhood, who would it be to and what would it say?
To my own mum, definitely. She said to me, I will cry probably when I say this. I'm just going to compose myself. Sorry, guys. She said to me, when it came to your recovery, she was like, you were an athlete. It was like watching an athlete. My own mum, though, I feel like she taught me how to train. She taught me how to lift those weights. So a big thank you to her, because I used to be like, all my mum does is work, work, work. And now I'm like, any woman, sometimes women do find after having babies, they want to throw themselves back into work. Maybe that's because that's what they're good at. Maybe that's because they want to do that. But maybe that's because sometimes they find that's the only place they can actually exist or be or survive or what they're good at. There's no shame in that and wanting to work. And I used to think that about my mum. And now I'm like, do you know, she did all of that. And she survived for years undiagnosed. She wasn't medicated. She was given stuff for her blood pressure. But she survived extreme postnatal depression and all on her own. And she was adopted by mum. So she didn't have close family and friends nearby. And she was from not London. She wasn't from London. So my mum's just been amazing. Amazing, yeah.
I would like you to finish these three sentences.
Okay.
Being a mum means?
Looking at yourself in the mirror. Means looking at yourself in the mirror? Yeah, yeah.
Since being a mum,
I'm strong, boy.
And I'm happy when?
I'm exercising or eating.
Thank you so much for coming on. I literally could have spoken to you for another hour.
You're very, very good at your job.
Thank you.